5. It was a busy day for Pyotr Stepanovich. From von Lempke, he hastened to Bogoyavolensky Street, but as he went along Bykovy Street, past the house where Karamazinov was staying, he suddenly stopped, grinned, and went into the house. The servant told him that he was expected, which interested him, as he had said nothing beforehand of his coming. But the great writer really had been expecting him, not only that day, but the day before and the day before that. 3 days before, he had handed him his manuscript, Merci, which he had meant to read at the literary matinee at Yulia Mikhailovna's fete. He had done this out of amiability, fully convinced that he was agreeably flattering the young man's vanity by letting him read the great work beforehand. Pyotr Stepanovich had noticed long before that this vainglorious, spoiled gentleman, who was so offensively unapproachable for all but the elect, this writer with the intellect of a statesman, was simply trying to curry favour with him, even with avidity. I believe the young man guessed at last that Karamazinov considered him, if not the leader of the whole secret revolutionary movement in Russia, at least one of those most deeply initiated into the secrets of the Russian Revolution, who had an incontestable influence on the younger generation. The state of mind of the cleverest man in Russia interested Pyotr Stepanovich, but hitherto he had, for certain reasons, avoided explaining himself. The great writer was staying in the house belonging to his sister, who was the wife of a Kammerherr, and had an estate in the neighbourhood. Both she and her husband had the deepest reverence for their illustrious relation, but to their profound regret, both of them happened to be in Moscow at the time of his visit, so that the honour of receiving him fell to the lot of an old lady, a poor relation of the Kammerherrs, who had for years lived in the family and looked after the housekeeping. All the household had moved about on tiptoe since Karamazinov's arrival. The old lady sent news to Moscow almost every day, how he had slept, what he had deigned to eat, and had once sent a telegram to announce that after a dinner party at the mayor's he was obliged to take a spoonful of a well-known medicine. She rarely plucked up courage to enter his room, though he behaved courteously to her, but dryly, and only talked to her of what was necessary. When Pyotr Stepanovich came in, he was eating his morning cutlet with half a glass of red wine. Pyotr Stepanovich had been to see him before, and always found him eating his cutlet, which he finished in his presence without ever offering him anything. After the cutlet, a little cup of coffee was served. The footman who brought in the dishes wore a swallow-tail coat, noiseless boots and gloves. "Ha-ha!" Karamazinov got up from the sofa, wiping his mouth with a table napkin, and came forward to kiss him with an air of unmixed delight, after the characteristic fashion of Russians, if they are very illustrious. But Pyotr Stepanovich knew by experience that, though Karamazinov made a show of kissing him, he really only proffered his cheek, and so this time he did the same. The cheeks met. Karamazinov did not show that he noticed it, sat down on the sofa, and affably offered Pyotr Stepanovich an easy chair facing him, in which the latter stretched himself at once. "'Wouldn't like some lunch?' inquired Karamazinov, abandoning his usual habit, but with an air, of course, which would prompt a polite refusal. Pyotr Stepanovich at once expressed a desire for lunch. A shade of offended surprise darkened the face of his host, but only for an instant. He nervously rang for the servant, and, in spite of all his breeding, raised his voice scornfully as he gave orders for a second lunch to be served. "'What will you have, cutlet or coffee?' he asked once more. "'A cutlet and coffee. And tell him to bring some more wine, I am hungry,' answered Pyotr Stepanovich, calmly scrutinizing his host's attire. Mr. Karamazinov was wearing a sort of indoor wadded jacket with pearl buttons, but it was too short, which was far from becoming to his rather comfortable stomach and the solid curves of his hips. But tastes differ. Over his knees he had a checkered woolen plaid reaching to the floor, though it was warm in the room. "Are you unwell?" commented Pyotr Stepanovich. "No, not unwell, but I am afraid of being so in this climate," answered the writer in his squeaky voice, though he uttered each word with a soft cadence and agreeable gentlemanly lisp. "I've been expecting you since yesterday." "Why? I didn't say I'd come." "No, but you have my manuscript. Have you read it?"
"Manuscript? Which one?"
Karamazinov was terribly surprised.
"But you've brought it with you, haven't you?"
He was so disturbed that he even left off eating and looked at Pyotr Stepanovich with a face of dismay.
"Ah, that bonjour you mean. Merci."
"Oh, all right. I'd quite forgotten it and hadn't read it. I haven't had time."
"I really don't know. It's not in my pockets. It must be on my table. Don't be uneasy. It will be found."
"No, I'd better send to your rooms at once. It might be lost. Besides, it might be stolen."
"Oh, who'd want it?
But why are you so alarmed? Why, Yulia Mikhailovna told me you always have several copies made, one kept at a notary's abroad, another in Petersburg, a third in Moscow, and then you send some to a bank, I believe."
"But Moscow might be burnt again, and my manuscript with it."
"No, I'd better send at once. Stay, here it is." Pyotr Stepanovich pulled a roll of notepaper out of a pocket at the back of his coat. "It's a little crumpled. Only fancy. It's been lying there with my pocket handkerchief ever since I took it from you. I forgot it." Karamazinov greedily snatched the manuscript, carefully examined it, counted the pages, and laid it respectfully beside him on a special table for the time, in such a way that he would not lose sight of it for an instant.
"You don't read very much, it seems," he hissed, unable to restrain himself.
"No, not very much."
"And nothing in the way of Russian literature?"
"In the way of Russian literature? Let me see. I have read something. On the Way, or Away, or At the Parting of the Ways. Something of the sort. I don't remember. It's a long time since I read it. 5 years ago. I've no time."
A silence followed.
"When I came, I assured everyone that you were a very intelligent man, and now I believe everyone here is wild over you."
"Thank you," Pyotr Stepanovich answered calmly.
Lunch was brought in. Pyotr Stepanovich pounced on the cutlet with extraordinary appetite, had eaten it in a trice, tossed off the wine and swallowed his coffee.
"This boar," thought Karamazinov, looking at him askance as he munched the last morsel and drained the last drops. "This boar probably understood the biting taunt in my words, and no doubt he has read the manuscript with eagerness. He is simply lying with some object. But possibly he is not lying, and is only genuinely stupid. I like a genius to be rather stupid. Mayn't he be a sort of genius among them? Devil take the fellow."
He got up from the sofa and began pacing from one end of the room to the other for the sake of exercise, as he always did after lunch.
"Leaving here soon?" asked Pyotr Stepanovich from his easy chair, lighting a cigarette. "I really came to sell an estate, and I am in the hands of my bailiff."
"You left, I believe, because they expected an epidemic out there after the war."
"No, not entirely for that reason," Mr. Karamazinov went on, uttering his phrases with an affable intonation,
and each time he turned round and pacing the corner, there was a faint but jaunty quiver of his right leg.
"I certainly intend to live as long as I can," he laughed, not without venom. "There is something in our Russian nobility that makes them wear out very quickly, from every point of view. But I wish to wear out as late as possible, and now I am going abroad for good. There the climate is better. The houses are of stone, and everything stronger. Europe will last my time, I think. What do you think?"
"How can I tell?"
"If the Babylon out there really does fall, and great will be the fall thereof, about which I quite agree with you, yet I think it will last my time. There's nothing to fall here in Russia, comparatively speaking. There won't be stones to fall. Everything will crumble into dirt. Holy Russia has less power of resistance than anything in the world. The Russian peasantry is still held together somehow by the Russian god, but according to the latest accounts, the Russian god is not to be relied upon, and scarcely survived the emancipation. It certainly gave him a severe shock. And now, what with the railways, what with you, I've no faith in the Russian god.
And how about the European one?
I don't believe in any. I've been slandered to the youth of Russia. I've always sympathized with every movement among them. I was shown the manifestos here. Everyone looks at them with perplexity, because they are frightened at the way things are put in them, but everyone is convinced of their power, even if they don't admit it to themselves. Everybody has been rolling downhill, and everyone has known for ages that they have nothing to clutch at. I am persuaded of the success of this mysterious propaganda, if only because Russia is now preeminently the place in all the world where anything you like may happen without any opposition. I understand only too well why wealthy Russians all flock abroad, and more so every year. It's simply instinct. If the ship is sinking, the rats are the first to leave it. Holy Russia is a country of wood, of poverty, and of danger. The country of ambitious beggars in its upper classes, while the immense majority live in poky little huts. She will be glad of any way of escape. You have only to present it to her. It's only the government that still means to resist, but it brandishes its cudgel in the dark and hits its own men. Everything here is doomed and awaiting the end. Russia, as she is, has no future. I have become a German, and I am proud of it.
But you began about the manifestos. Tell me everything. How do you look at them?
Everyone is afraid of them, so they must be influential. They openly unmask what is false, and prove that there is nothing to lay hold of among us, and nothing to lean upon. They speak aloud while all is silent. What is most effective about them, in spite of their style, is the incredible boldness with which they look the truth straight in the face. To look facts straight in the face is only possible to Russians of this generation. No, in Europe they are not yet so bold. It is a realm of stone. There is still something to lean upon. So far as I see and am able to judge, the whole essence of the Russian revolutionary idea lies in the negation of honour. I like its being so boldly and fearlessly expressed. No, in Europe they wouldn't understand it yet, but that's just what we shall clutch at. For a Russian, a sense of honour is only a superfluous burden, and it always has been a burden through all his history. The open right to dishonour will attract him more than anything. I belong to the older generation, and, I must confess, still cling to honour, but only from habit. It is only that I prefer the old forms. Granted, it's from timidity. You see, one must live somehow what's left of one's life. He suddenly stopped. I am talking, he thought, while he holds his tongue and watches me. He has come to make me ask him a direct question, and I shall ask him. Yulia Mikhailovna asked me by some stratagem to find out from you what the surprise is that you are preparing for the ball tomorrow, Pyotr Stepanovich asked suddenly.
Yes, there really will be a surprise, and I certainly shall astonish, said Karamazinov with increased dignity. But I won't tell you what the secret is.
Pyotr Stepanovich did not insist.
There is a young man here called Shatov, observed the great writer. Would you believe it? I haven't seen him.
A very nice person. What about him?
Oh, nothing. He talks about something. Isn't he the person who gave Stavrogin that slap in the face?
Yes.
And what's your opinion of Stavrogin?
I don't know. He's such a flirt.
Karamazinov detested Stavrogin, because it was the latter's habit not to take any notice of him.
That flirt,
he said, chuckling. "If what is advocated in your manifestos ever comes to pass, we'll be the first to be hanged." "Perhaps before," Pyotr Stepanovich said suddenly. "Quite right, too," Karamazinov assented, not laughing, and with pronounced gravity. "You have said so once before, and do you know, I repeated it to him."
"What? You surely didn't repeat it?"
Karamazinov laughed again. "He said that if he were to be hanged, it would be enough for you to be flogged, not simply as a compliment, but to hurt, as they flog the peasants." Pyotr Stepanovich took his hat and got up from his seat. Karamazinov held out both hands to him at parting.
"And what if all that you are plotting for is destined to come to pass?"
he piped suddenly, in a honeyed voice with a peculiar intonation, still holding his hands in his.
"How soon could it come about?"
"How could I tell?" Pyotr Stepanovich answered rather roughly. They looked intently into each other's eyes.
"At a guess, approximately,"
Karamazinov piped still more sweetly.
"You'll have time to sell your estate and time to clear out, too," Pyotr Stepanovich muttered still more roughly.
They looked at one another even more intently. There was a minute of silence. "It will begin early next May and will be over by October," Pyotr Stepanovich said suddenly.
"I thank you sincerely,"
Karamazinov pronounced, in a voice saturated with feeling, pressing his hands.
"You will have time to get out of the ship, you rat," Pyotr Stepanovich was thinking as he went out into the street.
"Well, if that imperial intellect inquires so confidently of the day and the hour, and thanks me so respectfully for the information I have given, we mustn't doubt of ourselves." He grinned.
But he really isn't stupid, and he is simply a rat escaping. Men like that don't tell tales.
He ran to Filipov's house in Bogoyavolensky Street.